Good morning. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to all of our virtual annual meeting attenders as well. We're kind of nervous here. We're live on the internet, so we're not sure what that means, but glad you all could make it. My name is Kathy Holsing, and I'm the Director of Learning Design for the College of Liberal Arts at Penn State. I have two of my colleagues here with me. Gary Chin is the Interim Director for the E-Learning Institute in the College of Arts and Architecture at Penn State. And Tim Langle is an instructional designer at our Harrisburg campus, which is Penn State Harrisburg, part of Penn State as well. And we're here to talk to you this morning about building a strategic plan for your online courses for accessibility. So let's go ahead and get started. We've introduced ourselves to you, but we're going to start, before we start talking, with a question. And I'm hoping that this is going to work here. We're going to use something called Poll Everywhere. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but if you have a mobile device or your laptop, we're going to ask a question. And there's different numbers that you can text or add in on the online to answer the questions. We think it might be working here. Okay. So the question is, how is accessibility for online courses handled at your university, your campus? By a centralized disability services unit? By a centralized teaching and learning group? Okay, that is
37607.
That's why.
Choice C is by a centralized technology group. D is by individual faculty, or you're not sure, or no one is handling it. So text one of those responses to 37607, and we'll see what everyone's doing out there.
Just a really quick note while voting's going on, because we're part of the virtual meeting, when we get to the question part of the session, you could go to one of the microphones so that the people attending virtually can hear the question.
Thanks. Can you read the options one more time?
Number one, by a centralized disability services unit. Two, by a centralized teaching and learning group. Three, by a centralized technology group. Four, by individual faculty. Five, you're not sure. Or six, no one is really handling it.
Okay, sure.
Okay. Well, I guess we should have had another category there, so. We'll give it a couple more minutes here, but it looks like on many of your campuses it's being handled by individual faculty. So people are kind of on their own. Looks like a number of you have a centralized disability services unit. All right, so it looks like it's a little bit, you know, kind of across the board, a lot of different ways of doing it. I think at Penn State, we're doing a lot of those things as well, and probably not all of them as well as we could be. But let me talk for a few minutes kind of about the structure of Penn State. It's not all just one big group, unfortunately, which makes this kind of an initiative even more complicated. We have our World Campus, which is our Penn State's virtual campus. It's been in existence since 1998, but we've been offering distance courses for over 100 years at Penn State. We have, depending on how you count it, between 80 or 90 fully online programs. And there's a very large learning design staff that works at the World Campus with all of our academic partners across the university to help the faculty design and develop courses, and those people have an accessibility group at the World Campus. In addition to that, We have a number of college learning design units that all have instructional designers, learning designers, and technology staff working for them. Gary and I are both part of one of those units. I'm in liberal arts. He's in the College of Arts and Architecture. Our staff develops online courses to deliver either for students at the University Park campus or through the World Campus. So now we have this whole other group of people that are basically doing the same thing. But to make it even more complicated, we have 24 campuses besides the main campus, University Park, across the state of Pennsylvania. And most of those campuses also have learning designers and are also offering online courses. That's where Tim, that's the kind of campus Tim is at. He's at one of our smaller campuses in Harrisburg. And so there's a whole staff of people there that are doing the same thing. So what we're saying here is that there's a whole group of people at Penn State that are supposed to be responsible for making sure that our online courses are accessible and that we're, you know, that anyone with any kind of a disability is able to access our courses in a good manner. This is important to Penn State because many of you may know that in 2010, the National Federation of the Blind filed a suit against the university, a complaint, saying that we had discriminated against blind students. And this was not only in our online courses, but it was even more pervasive. It was in our learning management system. It was in our library services. It was in our department websites. So it was kind of a big deal at Penn State. And, you know, there was a lot of focus and a lot of effort put into trying to make sure that this was rectified. So one of the outcome of the settlement between Penn State and the National Federation of the Blind was that for all university websites that we were going to adopt the WCAG 2.0 accessibility standards, and that by October 15th, 2014, any Penn State website was going to be that was published after 2009 was going to be fully accessible to anyone who was blind, and by extension then for any other kind of disability like a hearing impairment and so forth. So that's kind of, you know, what our structure is like and why we're kind of at the point that we're at today. One of the initiatives that we did then to work on this to meet this goal was to gather a large group of people together. It was called the Online Course Accessibility Quality Initiative Task Force. There's a mouthful. I was looking at a lot of different things about online courses, but one of them was to try to make sure that they were accessible. So now Gary's going to talk to you a little bit about why we were working together and how this all came together.
So as Kathy mentioned, on the online side, Penn State is very active, has been for 15 years through the World Campus, and one of the driving forces behind our committee getting together and trying to make some sense of everything was, as Kathy mentioned, there is a lot of activity going on in the online world, but as we're going to see, increasingly it's distributed in different units. So it makes it a challenge to be consistent and have processes that work for everyone. By way of brief overview, and these are numbers from a couple years ago, so the enrollments are a bit higher. But on the online side, we're looking at somewhere on the order of 46,000 enrollments by 12,000 students. Kathy mentioned that, I think we are up to closer to 90 degree and certificate programs now across 12 different colleges. So it's a large operation. Before I get into the specifics of what our group did and why, I wanted to mention that, as you can probably tell by our titles and where we sit, we are not, accessibility is not the main part of our job. So a lot of the things we're going to look at today, the documents that we have, and just as a note, we have the documents that we're going to be talking about loaded to our session on the ELI meeting site. So you can download them later, hopefully take them back to your institution and improve them. But I wanted to mention that, you know, we are really kind of practitioners. We know, we deal with accessibility in a similar way that we deal with copyright and FERPA and these kinds of requirements.
A little closer, Derek.
Yeah.
Thank you.
it's something that we need to know about, but I don't think that anyone would disagree that we're not experts in this area. So who are the experts? So these are the groups that we rely on within our institution: Office for Disability Services, Learning Design at World Campus has a very active accessibility unit, and then our central IT group actually has accessibility people as well. So our online learning development is distributed, and in many ways the work on the accessibility side is distributed as well in a couple of different units at the institution. So that brings us to why our group decided to try and come together and put some thought behind ways we could improve. One of the drivers behind the documentation that we tried to work out was this notion that as these units keep appearing, and we'll get into a little bit later the differences, size and resources, but we thought it would be beneficial to a hypothetical new unit that was just evolving at a college in the online space, ready to build courses, but wouldn't really have a place to start. It's pretty overwhelming. I don't know how familiar people are with accessibility for online courses, but there are a lot of great resources. It's a little overwhelming to kind of scan through all of them. So we have differences in staffing, and later on, after we look at the documents, we're going to talk a little bit more specifically about our units. We have differences in our organization. We have differences in expertise. So one of the examples that we're going to look at later is who is the point person for accessibility at our units, and it varies. So our point person, I would say the person with the most familiarity in our unit is a multimedia developer. That's going to differ. It's going to be an instructional designer somewhere else. It may be the administrator at another unit. Differences in platform and tools. One of the areas that we looked at are the course management systems, but there are also other platforms. How do you evaluate third-party tools for accessibility as well? And then differences in course design, media, and enrollment. So from my college, as an arts college, our courses look fundamentally different. They're very heavily media-based. We do a lot of work with theater, with School of Music, with visual art and art history, and there are different demands on the accessibility side for the kinds of online content that we create. So moving to the how, in terms of collaborating, what we were trying to get to was more of a template-driven process that would let us cover what we needed to cover, but also allow for the customization and the variety of the individual units. So the project was split up among several units, and we're three of the representatives of that bigger group. And then the whole idea with the group was to come up with something that we could vet with each other, but really the final goal of the documents that you can look at later, they are intentionally supposed to be pretty concise, or as concise as possible, or if you're a fan of the, well, attributed to Einstein quote anyway, simple as possible, but not any simpler. So has everything that it needs in there, but is something that is really usable for a unit that's developing online coursework. As far as the what, we're going to look at three different documents or that we created as part of this project, and they're addressing a couple of different needs. I put down college-level need, but this could be, if you're a small enough institution, this could be the entire institution. But from a strategic perspective, something that'll help you get some kind of compliance statement or overall plan for new courses and existing courses, how you're going to approach accessibility. For an e-learning unit like mine or like Kathy's, the other document, the second document that's going to look at the audit, the program audit, really is something that's going to help scan across the existing courses and figure out where to start from a triage perspective, right? So hypothetically, if you had 20 courses in your portfolio and you had this edict to be compliant, which ones do you do? What do you do? Where do you start? So part of our thinking was, how do you make those decisions? Where do you put your resources first? Obviously, the longer-term goal would be that everybody is fully compliant with all courses. But realistically, you're going to have a process, and something's going to have to come before something else. So we'll look a little bit at what counts and how much it counts and where do you start. And then on a course level, and this is something that really is meant to be used by instructional designers, multimedia developers, or someone who's assisting with looking specifically at a course page by page, we have a lightweight checklist that goes through the what we identified as the main aspects of a course that would need to be verified for accessibility. So as I mentioned, we are going to be looking at three different things. The strategic plan is to create your approach. It's going to look at timelines and resources. The portfolio audit, again, that's the scanning and triage, and then the checklist for essential elements within a course. So I'll pass it on.
Okay, so the first document then that we're going to show here, and again, if you go to our session page at the ELI website, you can download all of these and feel free to modify these for use in your own institution. But this was the template that was kind of at the college level or the unit level to kind of say, okay, what's the plan? How are we going to roll this out? What are the things that we need to think about in order to get where we need to be and get the courses accessible and get them to where the point that they need to be at? So the first step was to determine the timeline. As I said earlier, we had a deadline at Penn State of October 2014. We are giving people a lot of information and can go back to our accessibility website to go and look at that and kind of see the kinds of information that we were supposed to comply with. This included password-protected courses, so even though they were not publicly available, we were including them in this audit, so that's why we're up here today to talk about how we've used this for our online courses. What we hope to do is start from where we're at. In other words, when we develop a new course, let's make sure it's accessible going forward. So the things that we're talking here are more to kind of retrofit the courses that are already in the pipeline and make sure that they are accessible and we've done everything that we need to do. But hopefully, if we do both parts of that process well, eventually we'll only be working on the new courses or on courses as they're being revised. So that this is a way to kind of do two things at once. But with our existing courses, as Gary mentioned, there needs to be a way to prioritize which ones do we look at first. Why are we choosing that one? Do we just start with letter A in the alphabet, or do we have a good way to kind of determine which are the courses that are the most important? Step two would be to identify what are the resources you have. Each unit is a little different. On my staff, I have 9 people that work on learning design. So we have a person on my staff who is an accessibility expert. That isn't all she does, but that's kind of one of her focuses. And so she's the person who we go to with questions about accessibility. She works with some of those people across those other units that Gary mentioned to keep up to date on that, all that kind of information. So we have kind of a point person on our staff to do that. In some of the smaller units, there may just be one individual there. So each unit kind of needs to identify, okay, what resources do we have? And if we don't have any resources, then someone needs to get some training. And how do we do that? What kind of training is needed? And then what kind of training is available to get someone up to speed to be able to handle that process? What university resources are available? As you can imagine, Penn State did put some time and resources into this initiative, so there were some things that were available. For example, we have a number of different places across the university where we have JAWS installed on a computer. So someone could actually go to that computer, pull up a website, and listen to the screen reader read the website and make sure, well, does this make sense? Is it going through in a logical format so that someone who is blind would be able to look at that site? So those are the kinds of resources that the university made available in our case to try to help that process. And then outside the university, there are a number of established resources that people at Penn State can utilize. For example, we use a couple of different outside vendors who transcribe all of our videos for us. 3Play Media is one that we use. We also use automated sync technologies. So anytime we create a video that we're using in one of our online courses, we'll send that video to that company, have them create the transcript, and they send that back to us, and then we can close caption. So this was a chance for the units across Penn State to look at what was available in their own shop, what the university provided for them, and then what other outside resources they might be able to tap into. Step three was looking at the course platform, the CMS. This is something that's, again, rather just happens in different ways across Penn State. Our learning management system is Angel, but there's a number of different course management systems where we put our course content. Some units just put everything into Angel. Other units use a Drupal platform. Other units use a platform that was built on Plone. And the World Campus has their own system that they've developed in-house. So there's four different ways that people might store course content for an online course. So one of the things, obviously, that you would need to look at is, okay, well, what's the accessibility of the whole CMS? If you're putting all of your course content into Angel and that's developed and run by Blackboard, well, then there's not a lot of things that we can do to change the accessibility of Angel itself. We can certainly bring things to the attention of people who might be able to make that change. But if you are hosting your course content on some outside system that you do have some control over, then there would be a way to make sure that those systems were accessible. Much of that depends on the templates that you use to build those web pages, making sure those are accessible, and then hopefully the content that's put in there will also be accessible. But again, that we were asking the people to look at what they have, look at the different options that are available, and then kind of compile those findings and determine what they're able to handle themselves and what would need to be handled by someone else. Step four was to actually go through and audit the course portfolio itself. Tim's going to talk a little bit more about the process that we used for that. And that's really the meat of kind of looking at what courses you have and determining what would be the best way to address them and where to start. Out of that audit, then we'll determine the priority of which courses we should start working on first. And we'll talk about the decisions that we made to determine what that ranking is. And then once we've decided that and we've settled on, okay, we're going to start looking at this course first, then we have a checklist that you can go through and actually say, for each individual course, here's the things that we need to check. So we're going to talk in a little more depth about each one of those last three steps there, starting with the auditing the course portfolio.
So the course portfolio audit. So one of its main functions is to prioritize which course to start with. But one thing actually working through this that I realized is it makes you see all your courses in one space, which sometimes doesn't happen in a unit, especially when you have multiple people doing different courses. So now all of a sudden you see, oh, I thought we only had 62 online courses. Actually, we have 140. So it kind of makes the task seem a little bit, it blows it up a little bit. But then it allows you to prioritize, like I said. So what this document does is it simply allows you to see how many students are in your courses by showing you the enrollment, how many times it is offered throughout the semester. So that's your first main number, is the total annual enrollment. It also shows you if it's a required prerequisite. So not only do you see how many students are in the course, but, you know, are all the students in the program going through the course? It gives you a list for third-party media, such as streaming video, if you're using VoiceThread, And it also allows you to list the multimedia elements of the course. So, and as Kathy mentioned, there's multiple content management units that we use at Penn State. So you can list those there as well. So it's a document that allows you to see your whole portfolio in one space. And probably one of the more interesting things are the spaces that you see in your document as you're putting it together. So you realize that, wow, I don't know what is publicly available, and I don't know the instructor that's working on that course. So the questions that come from this document make you open more doors. But like, it gives you a point to start with and a point to end with. So like I said, you can see really, really quickly, like, wow, there's 105 students going through this course. It is a prerequisite. The revision cycle, which is over here, doesn't come up for another 2 years. So this course becomes your number one priority, essentially. So, and then you can also list the person you need to contact and the person you need to work with. So, and this is available online in our session notes. So look through that. If you have some more questions about this, hunt me down in the hallway, and I'll be glad to answer them. Sure.
So the course audit is kind of the medium level. If you look at it sort of in series of levels of granularity, we have sort of a strategic document, and then this is the scan across the portfolio. I'm going to look next at the checklist, the course level, which is very short. I kind of got the good one for the presentation. But one thing I wanted to mention is, for those of you who have some familiarity in this area, you know, there, as I mentioned before, there are a lot of resources out there. So our goal in this whole thing was not to to be the definitive resources. Really, one of the things that we were hoping to get was something that was cohesive and that were put together from the beginning to operate together. So all of us, especially at the college level, we have to deal with our administration for resources, resource allocation, and advocate for the kinds of things that we want to do. Accessibility can be a tricky one to advocate for sometimes. There's not a lot of understanding around it, typically. Administrators are very busy, and there may be some confusion over what we mean when we say accessibility. Is that open access? Is that mobile devices? What does that mean? So one of the goals of this series of documents and this process was really to give some consistent tools to people so that they could have a basis for going to their administration and saying, well, first of all, these are based on laws, and we have to do this. But also, here is the scope of work that we're talking about, and here are my resources, and I've put some thought behind this to identify what we need. So, you know, in a hypothetical situation, I need a budget allocation of X dollars for closed captioning for the videos in our online courses. And so, again, you know, internet's a big place. You can find accessibility information in any number of places. These are all supposed to be meant to work together. So the final piece of it, the course level checklist, is really meant to be the most applied. And I think the hope is that this is something that could be handled by more than one person within an e-learning unit. Or any kind of unit that is creating online courses. You look at the strategic document, that's really probably going to be driven by a person at the top of an e-learning organization. The scan is probably going to be managed by someone in a management, in a leadership position there, or if you have a program manager. But our hope with the accessibility checklist is that this is something that could be completed by any number of folks within a unit. And what we tried to do is distill what we saw as the pieces that we really want to make sure every course absolutely has. So we start with the accessibility statement, which at our institution is required to be in a part of the syllabus. Often it's not part of the syllabus. I don't know. It's probably very analogous to the academic dishonesty statements that are supposed to be in everyone's syllabi and often are missing. But in online courses, you know, they're important to include. So at the very beginning, we want to start there. We get in quickly into specifics that people may be more or less familiar with, depending on their role. But this is what I think is the real value of a checklist like this: is that not only can multiple people go through a checklist, but you can have multiple people responsible for different parts. So hypothetically, if you have a person who focuses on the web side, you know, the web design side of your courses, they could be looking at headers and links. You could have your multimedia people looking at the other information in terms of alternative tags for images and things like that. So really what we're looking for here is a way for a consistent structure to be around how courses are verified. In this, for this document, what you'd want is everything is checked, right? So this is like, you have to meet this as a threshold. The previous one, the audit, I think in a lot of ways that's a more, it's not more interesting, but there's more room there for debate, right? So we're going to look I'm going to talk a little bit about my specific college level unit, but you'll notice that when Tim was talking about the course audit, we have categories there, enrollments, how often it's offered, when was the last time it was revised. Right now, at the template that you can get, there are no weights to any of that. What I've found is the interesting conversations that have happened in my unit is among those things, which ones count more than others, right? So this is going to differ, and this is why we weren't just being sloppy. It's kind of left in your hands to decide this, right? So if highest enrollment is the way to go, that's one approach, then you can assign a score, a weighted score to that in the Excel file. It will basically result in a ranking, a numerical ranking, that will triage your course portfolio for you. So, but again, this one, you really want to get all of your check marks. It's almost like we'll call it mastery-based, right? So that's kind of how they work together. And again, you know, we had I think maybe six different representation from maybe six different units at our institution look at this. And it came from another committee. It was a charge from a higher committee. So we've had some people sit around a table and look at this. But one of the things that we were excited about with this conference is that now we can kind of put it out for vetting with a broader audience. And if there, and inevitably there will be, if you see areas for improvement, I think this would be a really valuable thing for a community to kind of take apart and rebuild. Okay, so we're going to try the poll again, and I will read the number for you, because that is really small. This time, our question is, now that you've seen the materials, what challenges would you foresee at your institution in using them? So our number is 3. I think, yeah, we do have an other, and that doesn't mean all, I guess. 37607, is that it? Yeah, 37607. I don't know why they make that part so small compared to the rest. It's kind of funny. So we'll let people chime in. The options are lack of resources, which is something that at least our unit is a consideration, and why these documents can be used for an advocacy approach. TERF for political issues, depending on the size of your institution, it might be more or less, but as you can see, we have three different units that just work in the accessibility space at our institution, and then we have 11 different college-level e-learning units and this massive distribution unit. lack of expertise on how to fix the issues uncovered. This, I think, ties directly back into resources, or can, because if you do identify something like captioning as a requirement for your videos in your online course, and you don't have expertise or resources, human resources available immediately, then you're going to have to figure out a plan for that. And we use 3Play Media as well for our captioning, and it's we've had good experience with them. Administrative apathy and other. So it looks like lack of resources is the number one, so we should probably work on that for next year. I think one of the, if you can make an argument that the complaint that was filed by the National Federation for the Blind, if you can make an argument that had a positive side to it, then I think the obvious one for our institution was that it put this issue at the center for our administration, for our central administration, but also our college level units. And you know, in a lot of ways, the way that you show that you are spending time and energy on something is resource allocation from an administrative perspective. So if there is an upside to it, and I think there was, it was a refocus or more highly focused effort and attention on this issue of accessibility for online that did lead to, I'm not going to say that it necessarily led to dollars rolling in to address these things, but I know that Kathy's unit and my unit do spend, we have a line item in the budget, the annual budget, for addressing accessibility issues. And what we're working on now is getting our staff developed so that they can do pieces of this as well, which is a different kind of resource allocation, but still an important one. Okay, I think what we're going to do, now is kind of talk a little bit more specifically about our units and how we took the documentation and process that we worked on and kind of took it back to our groups at the unit level and the different things that emerged from that experience.
So I'll briefly speak about health and human development and then Harrisburg. So lack of resources for implementation, that's right there at the bottom. That speaks for Harrisburg too. I think you quickly see how big the task is. But health and human development, their audit's nearly complete, and their courses have been prioritized, and the plan has been made to make all courses accessible. I'll just go through this briefly so we have some time for Q&A at the end. And Harrisburg, a little bit about Harrisburg. We have a staff of 4.5 people. We share one person. He's not a half person, but we share him. We support 62 online courses, and working through the portfolio, our list was about a little over 100. So that was a big difference in numbers. So that, going back to the audit, you realize how many courses you may actually have, and who you need to reach out to start working with people to make sure that their courses are also accessible. So we're close to completing the audit, and I've been working through the checklist on the courses that I've been developing, and you quickly realize the limitations that you face yourself. In your content management system or your images, so it's certainly, you realize how big of a task it is, and like I said before, it would definitely be nice to have one more person, you know, to help you always. So I'll turn it over.
So really quickly, by way of organizational description, we have a staff of 9 full-time and 1 part-time. supporting 45 courses. Most of our courses are general education. So the way we've used this process is a little bit different. So far, we have kind of deployed the checklist for new course development because that was sort of the lowest barrier for entry for us. Something that was relatively simple to do for new courses. The thing that's interesting, I sort of alluded to before, was the portfolio audit, in a lot of ways, was what got the most traction for us because we were already talking about our revision process. And I don't know how many people work online course development here, but revision is always a little tough. And what we what I found was that our revision process, so this is revisiting courses that are past a certain age and kind of updating. How often do you update it? And what are the drivers for updating? It was very reactionary at our institute. It was kind of, people walk through the door, they have time in the summer, maybe they would like some summer salary, and they want to revise a course. Happened to mention in passing to someone else that the course could use a refresh, and we do it that way. So what I thought was exciting about the portfolio audit, while we were going through this process on the accessibility side to kind of spec out what counts and how much, we decided to do the same thing with our course revision cycle. So we're in the process now of conversations around what counts to be triaged for revisions, for full course revisions. And so the accessibility piece of that is going to become a part of it. It's going to count for the revisions, but we're hoping to fold the process for looking across and then looking through the individual courses and coming up with the corresponding information into a larger process for revision.
Okay, and then just finally, in my college in liberal arts, we have about 9 staff managing about a little over 100 courses. As Gary did, we have gone through the process of reviewing our new courses with the checklist, but we haven't even done the audit yet. And I'm kind of embarrassed to say that. But what we have found is that I mentioned earlier we have this person who deals strictly with accessibility, and what that person has been spending a lot of time doing is as the semesters start and we find out that we have a student in a particular course who needs an accommodation, we're kind of playing catch up with, and okay, well, this course needs to be ready for that student, so what do we need to do for that specific student in the course, rather than being able to step back and take this overall look, which is what we had hoped to be able to do, to prevent having to do that. So we're kind of caught in this endless cycle of fixing things kind of one-off without being able to take a larger step back and prevent having to do a lot of that work on an as-needed basis. So, it's interesting that resources and time are an issue across, regardless of the size of the portfolio. So that's kind of what we all discovered as we were looking at this, is that, it seems like a pretty clear process, and there's 3 little documents, and, oh, yeah, this looks like it makes sense, but when you actually try to implement it, you realize how big the job actually becomes, and it kind of just grows on itself. We did want to mention that this, just let you know that there are a number of other people that contributed to this that weren't able to be here today from a number of the different units that we worked on this with. And with that, we're pretty much out of time, but I'll be glad if you have any questions. We'll be glad to try and take those. Yes. Can you move to the microphone? I'm sorry.
Looking at the accessibility policy that you have on your website, mm-hmm. Does that policy cover the courses? Did you have to create another policy that said all of your online courses would be accessible, or because they're hosted on university websites, they're assumed?
I think that was the assumption, that because they are hosted on university websites, even though they are password protected, and people can't access those unless they are a registered student for the class, we are extending that wording to include the online courses. So that's why we got involved in this initiative.
So I had a question about all the video and the closed captioning. So first of all, is the necessity to close caption everything, is that deterring people's use of video in their design of online courses?
You have a lot of videos.
Are you requiring them to provide the transcript, or are you just sending it away and having the service do the whole thing?
Yeah. So to answer, yes, we are sending it all away. Some units employ part-time student labor to do the captioning.
Yeah, we found out that was more expensive.
Yeah. We actually, so the big reason why we like 3Play is the turnaround time and their consistency. So they have a lot of experience with non-native English speakers and technical language. And there are surcharges if you don't have a standing contract with them for those. But to answer your question, so far, it has not been a deciding factor. But there is a cost associated with it. It's very reasonably could be down the road. We haven't had the volume where it has been a barrier yet. But the interesting thing about that question is, when that day comes, do we do less or do we get more from administration to address this?
Because who's paying for it?
Yeah. So without going into the complex budget models, we pay for it right now. Our unit,
like
our institute pays for it.
So the individual school or department or whatever pays for it, yeah.
Yeah.
And just one follow-up, because I don't want to monopolize, but what about a just-in-time, you know? So I'm doing, I had 16 questions about how to do this thing in Excel, so I'm going to throw up the quick screencast to show everybody. What's the policy on that?
That's a tough one. We don't do a lot of that. We do a fair amount of, week-level introduction videos, and those are sent out for captioning. Usually can get them back in 3 days. But I would be willing to bet there have been times we've had really quick turnaround things that have not been captioned. Yeah, that's a tough one.
I guess our policy on that has been, if it's something that's going to be in the course, for an extended period of time, a lecture video, if you want to call it that, we tend to get those captioned right up front. If it's something that an individual instructor is doing for this semester to explain a concept or something that, is kind of more of an ad hoc thing, then those we would not probably tend to get captioned right away, unless, of course, there was a student in the class who maybe needed that.
It's a really interesting question, though, for kind of online office hours or synchronous events.
I have a couple questions. First of all, where are you all housing those videos on your streaming server, or are you putting them on a YouTube where it is unlisted? And then my second thing is, are your faculty using, because when you use YouTube, you can do closed captioning.
Right.
And are they doing that? And Camtasia is another one that's been used a lot, and that also will do closed captioning. Have you had success with that when you do this?
So we do not use any of the, okay, I should back up. I think 3Play starts with, their process begins with the automated translation, voice-to-text translation, and then a human being goes in and verifies everything. Our problem with a lot of the voice-to-text, including YouTube, is the accuracy issues. We want to make sure that what's being said is what's being communicated. To answer your question about the videos, we do have our videos on a college level streaming server. We do quite a bit of turning around of some of our videos, because we do a lot of recording of performances, music performances, and theater performances. We turn around quite a few of those to be public facing outreach materials, and for that we do post those on our college YouTube channel. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.